Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. So more tapes to go through. There's always tapes to go through, it seems, with President Trump. And the Cohen tape that Michael Cohen, his sort of goofball fixer dude, taped conversations between him and his client, President Trump. 12 of those tapes have been turned over to the state. Privilege essentially has not been challenged. And the one that made the news over the weekend, now CNN obtained a copy of it somehow, probably from Michael Cohen.
Yeah.
Or Michael Avenatti.
No, I think they said Michael Cohen gave him the tape.
Okay, there you go.
And it's from 2016, and they're talking about a payment between
Trump
and Karen McDougal. She's not a paymate. She's a playmate. No, they were calling her the playmate turned paymate. Just listen.
Aren't they clever?
Aren't they?
I need to open up a company for the transfer of all of that info regarding our friend David. So that I'm going to do that right away. I've actually come up and I've spoken to Alan Weisselberg about how to set the whole thing up with funding. And it's all the stuff, because you never know where that company, you never know where he's going to be. Correct. So I'm all over that. And I spoke to Alan about it when it comes time for the financing, which will be.
Listen, what financing?
We'll have to. No.
You can hear him. It's kind of petering off at the end. I'll pay cash, and then Cohen goes like, no. And then he said, check, and then it cuts off. Dun,
wow.
dun. I mean, it's slimy. It feels
slimy.
Knock
me over with a feather.
It's slimy that Cohen, who's his alleged friend and the fixer and the gatekeeper, would secretly audio tape someone who is his boss, essentially. Someone who is hired by him.
After hearing that tape, you'll have Rudy Giuliani probably reiterate what he said over the weekend, that it's exculpatory. And you'll have Adam Schiff call for his impeachment. And you'll have John Brennan call for a firing squad. Which do you think? Exculpatory, ignore, impeachment, firing squad. 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro, answer line, 646-36DA, turnkey.pro text line. Now, Cohen, when he says our friend David.
Yeah, that's the editor or the owner of National Enquirer. So they paid her, paid David to hire her
as
an employee.
Are you
to get her story. So they paid, and they worked it through with a guy named Alan.
I'm sorry?
I said, I don't feel well. Okay, I'm trying to explain. Because my friends work at the Enquirer. They told me about this story a long time ago. They said, our boss got $150,000 paid for by this guy, Alan. And then in return, we paid Karen to tell her story to us. We interviewed her 3 times. It was a catch and kill. They had no intention of ever running the story. But then they let her do fitness articles that were just god-awful.
It's what Chicago is talking about. It's Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan and Amy on AM 560, The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. In other news, President Trump yesterday, Trump administration announcing $12 billion in aid to farmers who've been hurt by the trade war that he has sparked. $12 million in emergency relief for farmers. So President Trump engages in this trade war. Obviously, there are winners and losers because that's what mercantilism produces, government-directed winners and losers. by imposing taxation on some to the benefit of others. And so now he's hammering farmers, hurting them economically, and then he's going to take other people's money to subsidize them to minimize the damage. Well, this is sort of this endless cycle, which is why you don't want government in the business of picking winners and losers. So what about that? Those who were defending tariffs, taxes, as the means to level the playing field, as a tactic to get us to a lower tariff or zero tariff environment. How is that going? 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line. 64636DA, turnkey.pro text line.
They need markets and opportunities, not handouts. And farmers, and this one farmer that was profiled last night, his name's Dan Bartek, he's sick of what's ahead.
We need these tariffs to end sooner rather than later. The longer this goes on, it just makes it that much harder for us. Costs on our end seem to be going up all the time.
And they're afraid they're going to lose their farm.
What about steel users as opposed to steel producers across the economy? Should they be subsidized as well, all the way down the supply chain?
It's weird. And it's in September when they're going to hand out or give out these handouts, right before the midterm elections.
If this was the left doing it, we would be howling.
Yeah.
I am howling. I don't care that it's Trump doing it. Are you the Trump supporter? Are you getting impatient with the trade war that Trump has instigated? 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line. 64636DA, turnkey.pro text line. It doesn't have to be this way. This doesn't have to be the approach. Good piece in the Wall Street Journal from former executive for Caterpillar. Zero tariffs, there is a precedent. And the precedent is 30 years ago when the CEO of Caterpillar at the time, George Schaefer made a proposal to the U.S. trade rep. Tariffs on Caterpillar-type products are generally 2 to 2.5% in the United States, 4 to 10% in other developed countries, and more than 15% in most developing countries. Schaefer's remedy, to correct these inequities, we would propose that tariffs on earth-moving construction and material handling machinery and engines be completely eliminated worldwide. You should know that in some markets and with some products, tariffs actually produce immediate benefit to Caterpillar. But in the long run, we're confident our employees, customers, and investors are best served when we're allowed to compete in a totally open market. There it was. John Deere jumped on the bandwagon. International Paper was added. And a zero-tariff coalition was organized by Caterpillar. By the time the general would... back in the day, GATT, the precursor to WTO, was concluded in 94. The zero for zero list included pharmaceuticals, steels, toys, beer, distilled spirits, furniture, medical and mining equipment. It never obviously came to pass,
right.
But it's an approach that could have been taken and championed by President Trump.
Well, he told people, he was at the VFW speaking in Kansas City yesterday, and told farmers to basically be patient.
The farmers will be the biggest beneficiary. Watch. We're opening up markets. You watch what's going to happen. Just be a little patient.
And how farmers apply and receive the money, those details are still being worked out. But they don't want it to come to this. That's the problem.
Well,
it doesn't have to be like this.
Perhaps, obviously, farm subsidies has always been a political football. We talk about ethanol being the third rail of politics in Iowa every 4 years in advance of the Iowa caucus. Trump going to be in Illinois tomorrow in Granite City for that U.S. steel mill that's reopening.
And then he's off to Dubuque, Iowa, where that's going to be, I don't know what kind of reception he's going to receive.
Well, with the subsidies, it probably dulls the blade, but it shouldn't. Because he's doing this wrong.
Farmers don't like handouts.
The only good news from the tariffs is that newsprint tariffs could speed up the death of U.S. newspapers. Neiman Lab, the tariff increased the cost of tariffs that have been imposed, increased the cost of newsprint by as much as 30 to 35%. Some chains better in shape than others to to survive that increase in cost. For example, the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette's going to reduce its printing days from 7 to 5 next month. The Nevada Appeal in Carson City moves from 7 to just 2 days, and other newspapers are cutting their frequency of print products as well. Now, this is happening anyway, so the story is expediting, and I'm, of course, tongue-in-cheek. I'm not saying newspapers should go away. I don't want newspapers to go away, just many of the employees of those newspapers, a la the Daily News. But this against the backdrop of an economy that's doing well. U.S. manufacturing, much to the contrary of the conventional wisdom about the death of manufacturing in this country. Report last week on GDP by industry showed that real manufacturing output in the U.S. reached an all-time record high of more than $2 trillion in the first quarter of this year. All-time record high of real manufacturing output. It's taken a while for manufacturing to recover from the Great Recession, but it has recovered. And so, again, with all deference to Larry Kudlow and the idea that this is a medium-term play for a lower tariff environment across the board, I'm not seeing it, and we're not seeing it yet. Dennis in Villa Park, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Yeah, I was just thinking, I mean, just from the perspective of a liberal that's not for big business and how they make their obscene profits, how can they be mad if these big conglomerates, because that's pretty much what we're talking about, all the big farm companies, they're going to be punished with this tariff because they're not paying their fair share. Isn't that their perspective?
Well, you mean so liberals complaining about the subsidies to farmers? That's what you're asking.
Well, yeah, and then the major companies like Archer Daniels, all the big ones that are into farming.
Well, right. But the question, Dennis, is what about from the conservatives' perspective, the free marketeers' perspective? How do you look at Trump's trade policy and its impact so far?
From a conservative point of view, yes, I agree with you to a certain degree. I do understand that to try and get something to come down, you have to have some type of negotiating point. Maybe it's extreme. That's where I'm a little bit shady on, but I do agree that having a trade war isn't definitely a good thing.
All right. Thanks for the call, Dennis. Appreciate it. Alcoa, the top U.S. aluminum manufacturer, tariffs could wipe out $100 million of income at Alcoa this year. That's about 18% of profits last year. Alcoa CEO Roy Harvey saying tariffs will not solve the challenges facing the aluminum industry. Well, clearly. Remember, it was back in March, Commerce Secretary Wilbur Ross slapped a 10% tariff on aluminum and 25% on steel in the name of helping American metal manufacturers. So it's one thing to take the posture of America first. It's another thing to implement you punish your consumers, we punish our consumers. You punish your businesses, we punish your business. Eye for an eye, everybody goes blind approach to macroeconomics. That's what the Trump administration is doing right now, and there's cost to it. And it's not defensible, at least not from an Econ 101 perspective.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. Let freedom ring this afternoon at 2 with Sean Hannity, right before Joe Walsh at 5 on AM 560, The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. More moderate voices in the Democrat Party coming out to warn of the impending missed opportunity if the party is turned over to Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and the like. An interesting piece by David Van Dyke in Wall Street Journal. He's been active in Democratic national policy and politics for 40 years. To beat Trump, get a grip. The president political and media rage over Trump's sellout to Vladimir Putin is an overreach. He suggests that Democrats and media, he repeats himself, calling for Trump's impeachment, are engaged in a risky strategy. Trump, were they to pursue impeachment, even if they did get the House, could very easily be strengthened, as much as the possibility is that he would be harmed. Democrats need to take a fresh look at why and how Trump won the 2016 election. The idea that Trump won because of white supremacists and religious nuts and haters of all sorts, this is a failure to recognize what actually happened. President Trump was the consequence of a nationwide loss of confidence in all of the American establishment, political, media, cultural, business, financial. It's fascinating to hear some concern coming from Democrats. And the reason there's concern is because of pieces like this in the New Republic. There is no silent centrist majority. There's no place for centrists to land. There's no room for moderate voices other than on certain op-ed pages, moderate voices coming from the center left. And, then there's the examples around the world of what is being advocated by Comrade Bernie and AOC, the Juan and Eva Perón of America. We've talked a lot about Venezuela. What about what's going on in Nicaragua? It's in the 1980s all over again because Daniel Ortega is back in power. And our friend Brett Baer at Fox News had a fascinating interview with Daniel Ortega. Wow. Sort of surprising that Ortega agreed to sit down with him amid the protests of college students and others going on in Managua, the repression by the Ortega administration, murders, disappearances of protesters. And he sat down with Brett Baer to, I guess, try to do some sort of damage control. I don't think it went as well as he thought it would. Brett Baer asking Ortega about those government-sponsored disappearances and killings.
Why are paramilitary forces involved in armed actions against those who are protesting your government?
It's been a week now that turmoil has stopped. Matters are becoming more normal in the country, and there have been some demonstrations, both against and in favor of the government.
Yeah, he's sort of soft-pedaling that, but to Baer's credit, he doesn't let it go. He also points out that it seems like Ortega, who was instrumental in deposing Somoza some 40 years ago, has become Somoza, including establishing an authoritarian dynasty. The vice president of Nicaragua, Daniel Ortega's wife.
They are attacking protesters who have called for you to step down. They are attacking protesters who say that you eliminated term limits, that accuse you and your vice president, your wife, of setting up an authoritarian dynasty. They are attacking the Catholic Church that has spoken out against your government. So you are distancing yourself from all of these attacks?
First of all, in none of the peaceful demonstrations have we been attacked. At night, when there are no peaceful demonstrations, we've had clashes provoked by the paramilitary forces organized by people who are against the government and who have attacked and fought against police stations. Well, first of all, we're not talking about any dynasty. It never occurred to me to set up a dynasty. My wife, it's the first time ever she's been vice president. She'd not been vice president before.
No, so it's just a recent thing. Now, there's the sanitized version from the dictator, which is always what you get. Here's what actual people in the street are saying, like, for example, this woman whose son was killed, or I'm sorry, her nephew. This is the aunt of a young man who was killed by the government.
Por favor.
Please, the people, United Nations, come together to save us from this disgrace that we are living through. This is not just for the government and police to be able to do this to us. Innocent boys who have a future in front of them. Dead university students.
So you're talking in the hundreds so far. This has sort of been an underreported story with everything else going on geopolitically. Here is another example. I mean, Daniel Ortega is a Marxist revolutionary. He has been for 40 years, and now he's back.
How did he get back in office?
Well, countries, some of these countries that can't extricate themselves from the grip of terrible, poisonous philosophies like Marxism and poisonous leaders like Marxist dictators like Daniel Ortega. This is the culture, same things, the policies he's pursuing are the same policies being advocated by the quote-unquote Democrat socialists as they define themselves in this country. Now, they're, of course, not advocating taking a position that is pro-repression, but this is where it ends. And we see it in Central America, and we see it in South America, and we see it everywhere socialism has been implemented.
It doesn't work.
And the funny thing is, even at the sort of pedestrian level, The View, Meghan McCain stumped the ladies on The View by asking for a country where socialism works. I mean, the cultural Marxists who decry Trump as the authoritarian, they're defending a philosophy, gospel of ignorance, creed of envy, and all of that, and that produces nothing but strongmen. Has for 100 years and destroys countries. Cuba, with communism, socialism in a hurry. Nicaragua, Venezuela, just in our hemisphere. And nobody takes note of this on the left. They still believe in this utopian pablum coming from the likes of a bartender from the Bronx.
She's a year out.
I know, and she's a Boston University grad.
Ooh.
Shame on Boston University.
You've made the switch, and it feels so good. You've switched to Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. The question, which are you willing to give up to stay in Illinois? 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line. 646-36-DA, turnkey.pro text line. Which are you willing to give up to stay in Illinois? Your job, your pension, or your home? Your job, your pension, or your home? One of those three things, at least, you will be forced to give up if you stay in this state. And nothing changes with the political leadership and thus the policy choices. You will give up your home, effectively, its value. You will give up your pension, if you're in the public sector. You'll give up your job, regardless of what sector you're in, because employers aren't coming and employers aren't staying. Jobs are not being created here. And the job creators are fleeing like the place is on fire. Your job, your pension, your home, which one of the three, and it may be more than one, but we'll just start with one. Which one of the three are you willing to give up to stay here? 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line. 646-36-DA, turnkey.pro text line. We've done another property tax report updating Lake County property taxes. And we'll do the other Collar Counties report on those. Lake County, one of the highest effective property tax rates as a percentage of home value in the country. So we looked for the first 6 months of the year, community by community, at home sales and property tax data with respect to those same home sales and all of the municipalities that comprise Lake County. Give you a story about what's happening. The Galito home. In July 2005, Stephanie Galeotto. How about that? In July 2005, Stephanie Galeotto paid $219,000, that's $282 in today's dollars, for a three-bedroom, two-and-a-half-bath home in Grays Lake. The home's 2005 property taxes were $5,300, round numbers. That's an effective rate of 2.4%. She sold her home just a few weeks ago, July 6th, $197,000. Her tax bill this year, $79.71. Or about 4% of its sale value. She paid $282 in today's dollars in 2005. 13 years later, she sold it for $197. She took almost a $100,000 hit while paying 2.5% of home value and property taxes for those 13 years. The median effective rate in Grays Lake this year is among the highest in Lake County. It's also more than four times the national average, nearly twice the state average. Put it another way, $197,000 home in Indiana, the effective rate, property tax rate, percentage of home value, 0.89%. Yeah. So the $197,000 home that Galeotto was paying $7,900 in property taxes for in Grays Lake, that would be $1,750 in Indiana.
It's a huge difference.
$6,000 compounded annually. I mean, with the rate. 65 Lake County communities we looked at. 4% or more of their home's value each year is the property tax rate. Homeowners in Zion pay the highest, and this is a, you know, middle-income community, lower middle-income.
Yeah.
Median sale price in Zion this year, homes that sold this year, $116,000. Effective property tax rate, 4.28. $5,000 property tax bill on a $116,000 home.
That's just not fair.
It's destruction. It's destruction of home.
Highway robbery.
This is what I'm saying. So that's a taking. Your home is being taken. So that's why I go back to the question. Which are you going to give up? Your home, your job, or your pension? One or more are going to be taken from you by the political class in this state. That is happening, and it will continue to happen. I don't know how much more information in concrete terms can be provided so that this penetrates people's consciousness. I mean, it does when you go to sell your home. I'm sure Stephanie Galeotto had a wake-up call. William and Jennifer Zahn sold their four-bedroom, three-bath at 1909 Midday Drive in Zion, July 20th, for $197,000. It looked like a 31% increase from what they paid in 2011, $150,000. So let's, you know, go on the other side of the Great Recession. Oh, really? Oh, bought in $150,000 in 2011, sold it for $197,000 on July 20th of this year. Tidy little profit. Wrong. It's $150,000 in 11 is really $168,000 in today's dollars. Property taxes that Zahn's paid over 7 years, $37,000. Their last bill being $6,500, an effective rate of 4.3%. All told, they lost $9,000 on the deal. That's owning the home in the state for 6 years, 7 years.
So they got nothing from their investment.
Yeah, they lost money. It's a negative return. So, and you have homes in Zion that have become like homes on the west side or south side of Chicago. They are unsellable. Their actual market value is zero. Nobody's interested. Three-bedroom, one-and-a-half-bath, 3210 Bethel in Zion, sold for $22,000 to an investor who's now just trying to rent it. So that's what's happening. The same thing on the in Chicago neighborhoods. You buy it for nothing, and you just rent it out because there is no market for purchase. And it also freezes out people that are aspiring to home ownership, to laying down roots and then building equity and building wealth over the course of their working careers. Not available here. The previous owner of the home that sold for $22,000.
$22,000, that's awful.
She paid $133,000 for it in 2004, 14 years ago. $177,000 in today's dollars. $177,000 home in Zion in 2004 sold for $22,000 2 weeks ago.
There are a lot of homes for sale in Zion.
Realtor.com. 182 sold. 182 properties sold in Zion. 220 in Grays Lake. 254 in Gurnee. 240 in Buffalo Grove in the first 6 months of this year. Zion is the worst in Lake County, 4.28%. But Volo, Haynesville, Grays Lake, all over 4%. Lakemoor, Lake Villa, 3.6%. Lindenhurst, Beach Park, Third Lake, Round Lake, Round Lake Heights, Winthrop Harbor, Long Grove, Lincolnshire, all above 3%. This is three times national average. Kevin in Libertyville, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Good morning, guys. Hey, Dan, it's funny you should say, what do you want to lose? Because I would love to give up my house. The problem is we can't find a buyer. And we live in a very nice
community. Yeah, Libertyville's lovely.
Libertyville, it's, I mean, we had our kids. Our kids are grown out of the home. We don't need a five-bedroom house anymore. And so we put it on the market. We figured, oh, my God, this is going to sell in a week. It's so easy to get rid of. The market has literally collapsed. We have no buyers. We've lowered our price six or seven times. It's pathetic. I hear there's so many anecdotal stories about people who own million-dollar-plus homes are just capitulating and just getting out, figuring they'll recoup it on the long end by not paying the exorbitant taxes. If it wasn't so sad, it would be funny. But you almost want to say, can't there be something done with a class action lawsuit against corrupt, inept politicians? I mean, if someone walked into your house and stole $100,000, $200,000, $300,000 plus, you'd be in court in a heartbeat. But what do you do in this kind of a situation?
Yeah, it's tough because we've elected the thieves. Yeah, thanks for the call, Kevin. I appreciate it. Sorry to hear about the situation with your home. I mean, let me just give you a high-end example since he mentioned the seven-figure homes that do not sell. They are not selling. You're in the suburbs, you get above 600. Good luck. The 25,000 square foot Schweppe estate in Lake Forest, 27 rooms, 425 feet of beach on 5 acres. It's been on the market for a decade. The current sale price is $8.95 million. I mean, I know this is ridiculous, but it still gives you a sense of what's happening. $8.95 million. In 2008, the sale price was $18
million. Oh, my gosh.
Its asking price has fallen by $10 million. They slashed it in half.
What are their property taxes?
The property taxes have increased from $118,000 to $145,000 over the past decade.
Oh, my gosh.
Right? We've tried to explain this before. Your home value goes up, your property taxes go up. Your home value goes down, your property taxes go up. One thing is constant in Illinois. Your property taxes are going to continue to go up because the spend goes up. And the spend in the suburbs, driven by local school districts, it is always increasing. Enrollment's up, enrollment's down. Doesn't matter. Spend is increasing, property taxes are increasing. Pension benefits, salary and pension benefits, escalating. The unfunded liability is escalating, property taxes increasing. That's the constant. So home equity declining, if not being completely eviscerated. The same price as the Schweppe estate. for the same price, $8.95 million. Gets you $5,800 bucks. $5,800 square feet. 5,800 square foot, five bedroom, one third of an acre in Beverly Hills. Its tax bill is 40% of the Schweppes estate in Beverly Hills, California. Doesn't get you as much property,
property taxes?
But
what is their deal in California?
Yeah, they've got the cap from the referendum in the 80s. Tax policy in California. Well, that's right. Lewis in Dayton, Texas.
Good morning, Dan. How you doing this morning?
Morning.
I listen to your guys' show to be well informed, so I have a question and a comment. But before I get to that, I'd like to tell you, Dan, my dad last year sold his home in Illinois in Grays Lake. It was built in 1979. He paid $178,000 for it 10 years ago. It's a 3-bedroom, 1-bathroom. He actually lost on that because he only was able to sell it for $165,000. He moved out here, bought a 2-acre home built in 2002. It is a 3-bedroom, 2-bathroom, and it's he only paid $99,000 for it.
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
But my first question would be is, after everything, you listening to all the stats and everything you guys always throw out about Illinois, why is it that people aren't catching on to what's going on out there? I mean, everything I hear is people are losing this and losing that and they're taking it away, but yet you still have a lot of Democratic people out there that are still voting for these same people in office, even though they're taking everything away from them. They are still voting these people in office.
Yeah.
And that would be my first question. My comment would be is not what am I willing to give up to stay in Illinois. It is what is Illinois willing to do to keep me? Because if I leave, I take my money, my tax dollars with me. That's money that doesn't get pumped into the local economy there. I don't understand that part. Maybe you can inform me a lot better, Dan. I appreciate it.
Lewis, thanks for the call. That is the right question. What is Illinois willing to do to keep me here? That's the right question. That's what politicians should be asking themselves, but they're not. They don't care. Leave. Go ahead, leave. That's the attitude.
Yeah, because they'll line their coffers and then they'll leave too eventually.
Well, right. And also,
when they retire.
I mean, you leave, the productive people leave, as has been happening for 2 decades here, increasing in pace. And who's left? Champagne socialists that take the financial hit in the name of cultural Marxism, and beneficiaries of transfer payments. That's it. There's no middle. It's effectively California. And the other reason that people continue to vote for Democrats is because the Republicans have been complicit in all of this and have no message on the topic either. What's the one-off talk intermittently about property tax caps from the likes of, a pathological liar like Rahner or these other longtime political hacks in charge of the Illinois Republican Party in the House and the Senate? Who's buying what they're selling to the extent they're selling anything? Nobody. Why would they? We've only had, Durkin and Brady in the House and the Senate, 40 years combined to do something about this. How's it going? So why would anybody place any credibility with the Republican Party? Who's making the case? Some candidates are, challengers are, finally. Pam in Brookfield, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
I'm on the air just to say love
Hi,
you
Pam.
Guys, but you got the wrong question.
Pam,
what am I willing to give up that's already been taken from us?
Uh-huh.
The question is, why am I willing to stay?
Well, why are you?
The reason I'm willing to stay is because I believe change is possible, not through politics and pretense and taxes and this and that, but we the people stand up. And I'm willing to stay. It's not because I have no choice, but I'm not willing to run. I'll stand my ground, as the famous Tom Petty said.
Okay.
I'll stand my ground. Why do we stay? Because there's something deep inside of us. Let's quit the politics and get the we the people back together and cut the crap. Well, so I love you guys. Thank you.
Well, we stay because this is a world-class city, and we stay because our family is here. And we stay because our families helped, you know, they came to this country and helped develop this town. I mean, I don't know about you personally, but I know my uncle helped build John Hancock, put up the drywall. My grandpa helped Swedish Engineers Club with a number of buildings, and our history's here. That's why we stay.
Yeah. No, I think it's not an easy thing to leave a place that you don't want to leave. That's the sad commentary. People are doing it anyway. They don't want to leave. Mm-mm. They're pressed to leave. Ben in Oswego, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Yes, hi, Dan and Amy. I'm leaving. This is ridiculous. I live in Oswego. My property taxes, I mean, it's minor compared to whatever else is paying, but in context, I'm paying. Actually, Kendall County has been rated the highest tax county in the country per capita. And I've been getting crushed for the last 15 years. I had enough. I'm going down to Tennessee. Where all my friends are actually going to, everybody's going down there, no state income tax. Why the hell, excuse my language, why would I want to live in this state?
Thanks for the call, Ben. I don't have a great answer for you other than the one that Amy gave, but that's what keeps people here, obviously the ties that bind family and friends. Job, or you don't want to disrupt your kids' schooling, I get it.
And the sports teams, kidding.
Yeah, you don't want to...
You don't want to miss a Bears game.
White Sox, obviously.
Cubs.
You can come in. You can fly in and out, though, to see Sox games.
Yeah. You'll always have a seat.
The what?
It'll never be sold out.
There are good seats available. Vince in St. Charles.
Morning, guys. Of course, I would probably have to give up the job. You know, I look around, drive around the area a lot, and I see a lot of nice houses and would love to buy them, you know, would love to own them. But I can't stay in Illinois, so you're stuck. You want to stay here, like Amy said, but you can't because you're afraid of what's going to happen. I get into a discussion with a friend of mine at work, and he seems to think that all the states are alike, and I say they're not. He says, he laughed at me because I want to leave, and he kind of jokes around with it because he puts up things that make me laugh about Illinois being so bad. But I say Illinois is bad. He says it's not. Mm-hmm. So I will try to do my best to get out of here. But can I? Who knows? But I know it's going to get worse before it gets better.
There's no question about that. Thanks for the call, Vince. And we'll see if your friend is laughing when he goes to sell his home someday. Or actually, just tell him right now. Why don't you put it on the market just to test it? What you think it's worth versus what it's actually worth. I mean, if people don't care about their homes, the largest investment they're going to make in their lives for most people, then okay, fine. Then you don't care. I give up. You got me. You win. Congratulations. You won. What did you win? A home equity desert. Jim in Tampa.
Hey, guys. All of you all on the phone, we want you to come to Florida. It's. I used to live in Chicago. When I was in high school, my family moved down. It took me about 3 years to feel like this is where I live, but you get comfortable, and it's you have a Stockholm syndrome going on up there.
Yeah.
And also, Dan, I've said this to you before, you're like the splendid splinter, Ted Williams. He never left the Boston Red Sox and never won a World Series. You guys got to come down here. You're so good, but you're beating your head up against the wall, against these forces that you can't do anything about. So... And the last thing I'll say is, people, just imagine this moment. It's December, let's say, 21st. You wake up in the morning, and it's 75 degrees outside. Your friends in Illinois have to wake up 15 minutes early, start the car, you know, shovel the driveway, get the ice off their window just to go somewhere. I mean, we're in shorts, and it really is better, not to mention the whole tax situation. So come on down.
Thank
you.
Thank you for that Chamber of Commerce speech there, Jim. Appreciate that. Mike in Crown Point.
Good morning, guys. The way I look at it, I think they've already passed the tipping point in Illinois. It's in a death spiral. They've got only way to get elected is to, side with the people that are benefiting from the system, and so it's a situation where there's not much. We just have to wait for it to collapse, unfortunately. I don't see any way out of it.
Thanks, Mike.
Hear about the big stories of the day, then talk about them right here on Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer.
Hey, Joe Walsh here. My Second Amendment rights are, in fact, the most important rights we have. I'll explain again when freedom returns at 5.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. It's our favorite pastime, parsing the words of President Trump on tape and arguing about what he did or did not mean. Now we can do that with this Michael Cohen tape that was much discussed over the weekend and now has been released in pertinent part.
Yes, and it was given exclusively to CNN last night for Cuomo's show. Do you ever watch that show yet? He's still reeling that he's off the New Day show. Now he has his own show.
I continue to not watch Chris Cuomo, morning or evening.
Well, this is a big bombshell. Listen up.
I need to open up a company for the transfer of all of that info regarding our friend David. You know, so that I'm going to do that right away. I've actually come up and I've spoken to Alan Weisselberg about how to set the whole thing up with funding. And it's all the stuff. Because you know, you never know where that company, you never know where he's going to be. Correct. So I'm all over that. And I spoke to Alan about it when it comes time for the financing, which will be.
Listen, what financing?
We'll have to.
It's just so slimy. It's uncomfortable.
Well, there's the issue of Michael Cohen's unethical recording of a client. There's that issue. Then there's the issue of what is being discussed and the substance of it.
That's slimy too.
Well, I understand, but it's, you know, slime in, slime out, I suppose. He does say Cohen sort of introduces the idea of a financial arrangement, and Trump asks, you know, basically, what financial arrangement? Mm-hmm. So I don't know if this is exculpatory. I don't know if anyone cares. I don't know that this reaches the threshold, depending on what other evidence the Southern District of New York has gathered, of really putting President Trump in any legal jeopardy. That alone certainly doesn't do it.
Yeah, Alan Dershowitz was on the panel on CNN last night. He said, there's no federal crime. It's not an impeachable offense.
Well,
or is it? I mean,
The crime and impeachable offense are two different things. Remember, impeachment is a political decision and a political process. It's not a court of law. And so, I mean, we're House Democrats. We're Democrats to take charge of the House in November. They could decide that that was an impeachable offense. Now, I think it would be to their great detriment politically. So I don't think that serious people are going to take that 45 seconds and run with it to an impeachment proceeding. But I mean, just let's separate out criminal activity from the prospect of impeachment.
Yeah. American Media spent $150,000 for her story, which they never published. She claims she had a 10-month affair with Trump.
You know the president of American Media is? His name
David
is?
Pecker. Yeah.
Positively Dickensian.
Rudy Giuliani was on with Laura Ingraham defending his client.
First of all, the major point is it's outrageous that someone would tape his client surreptitiously. And number two, it's also foolhardy for them to try to kind of yell and scream and make believe what's on the tape. I agree with you, the tape is a little bit hard to hear, but I assure you that we listened to it numerous, numerous times. And the transcript makes it quite clear at the end that President Trump says, quote, don't pay with cash. Cohen then interrupts and says, no, 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 I got it. And then you hear distinctly, if you're careful and you slow it down, check. And then Cohen follows with no, 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 and then quickly cuts off the tape, which indicates exactly what President Dershowitz was saying, that Cohen doesn't want the rest recorded because it was too exculpatory from the point of view of the president.
So Cohen was recording in that moment at the time when he's President Trump's fixer. Giuliani's insinuating that he was trying to set him up so that he had something to extort Trump with, or at least to protect himself with, vis-a-vis Trump, potentially.
That's the only reason why you record conversations, right? To extort people? Because
Not the only reason. You can arguably want to memorialize a conversation so you had it exactly right rather than taking notes. I mean, there's other legitimate reasons, but this obviously is a bit underhanded and certainly not illegal in New York State, but certainly one would argue, and I think Giuliani wants to, unethical with respect to the canons.
Yeah, I think Trump and Cohen are at war now. And there's 11 other tapes that he claims he's going to slowly be leaking out.
Well, there's
to CNN, to whoever he decides.
There's these tapes that were turned over to the government because the assertion of privilege was not made by Trump. But is it clear at this point that all 12 of those tapes, this one included, are Cohen and Trump? It wasn't clear when it was first reported.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know. All he said was, or that CNN had repeated, was that the other tapes might come out.
Do you find?
I don't know what's on the tapes.
You know, even
I don't think Trump knows what's on the tapes.
Giving Trump the benefit of the doubt here, even with respect to his less than redeeming behavior throughout his life, and including up until recently, clearly. Even if you give him the benefit of the doubt, the associations that he has, Michael Cohen as your fixer. I mean, other people that were around the campaign. I mean, the one thing I will say is, personnel-wise, inner circle-wise, at least he has dramatically upgraded the talent around him from the talent pool available. I don't know why.
Scaramucci, too? I mean, that was 10 days, but
you
can't unsee that.
I mean, that's sort of like hangers-on in the campaign, but...
Yeah.
But I just don't understand. I mean, the guy was a real estate magnate, a billionaire, all these marquee projects, the celebrity. You couldn't put people around you that were better than this? Better than Michael Cohen? I mean, you know, that
guys he picked up in a New York bar or something.
Well, that is a judgment call, by the way.
Yeah.
So, you know, you have to be held accountable for your judgment calls, personnel-wise, and so does Trump, and, well, Michael Cohen is stinging him at minimum here. Marty in Naperville, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Hello, everybody. Question. I'm not buying any of this for the moment, but on the other side of the coin, if she did get $300,000, okay, and it's proven or whatever that she did, doesn't she owe the IRS quite a bit of money?
No,
I'm going through a business audit, and I've got to claim every nickel and dime, which is fine, including cash that was paid to me.
Yeah, right. Thanks for the call, Marty. Yeah, I mean,
she was given the money through her employer for her story and then for writing some fitness articles that never were published.
Right.
So she did claim, I mean, technically it was a salary she got from American Media.
Yeah, but there's no indication that she didn't pay taxes on it. I don't know. She hasn't released her tax returns, but nobody is asserting that she did anything other than follow the law with respect to her income. Bruce in Bloomingdale.
Good morning. I seem to remember that American Media was one of the companies that was attacked with anthrax letters after 9/11.
I don't recall. Well, maybe. NBC. Let's say they were. What's the point?
Just an odd coincidence. It was American Media out of Florida, and they were one of the ones that had some employees get really sick, and I believe one died.
Okay. All right. Thanks for the call, Bruce.
Conspiracy with you.
I don't see
the connection.
Yeah,
but
neither do I. But okay. Ralph and Rantoul.
Yeah. Good morning. Yeah, you know, it just gets more interesting every day.
Oh, yeah.
A few things. Number one, the head of American Media, I believe his name is David Pecker.
Yeah, Pecker.
Say no further.
Mm-hmm.
Is it Becker? I thought it was
no,
Pecker.
No, it's Pecker. It's Pecker. It's, as
like,
I said,
it is Pecker.
Positively Dickensian.
And also,
yes.
If I think it's a really interesting way to pay hush money is the paying of a story rights through a third party. Everybody gets a cut. She's supposed to stay shut up. Kind of interesting. Number three is, you know, if you need a fixer, so you're hiring a fixer, The recordings that the guy made, that's Fixer Insurance. So if you're involved in slimy stuff, why would you be surprised if your slimeball lawyer, who's hired to cover up slimy stuff, has slime insurance so that that he can maybe come out later and implicate you or, you know, clean him, get himself off the hook for something. I don't find any of it surprising,
if only,
telling of his story.
Yeah. If only Ray Donovan had been on the air before Trump retained Cohen, he would have known.
Yeah, and last but not least, I believe David Cohen's attorney is none other than Lanny Davis.
Yes, counselor.
From the past.
Yeah, counselor.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But, I mean, with friends like Cohen, who needs enemies? I mean, really.
With friends like Lanny Davis, I guess you don't need to really fight the Clintons head on either.
Well, right. And you know, just when you thought the slime factor couldn't go up, Lanny Davis is retained. Lanny, enter Lanny Davis.
Yeah, it's like a backed up sewer. The Clintons, they contaminate everything. It just keeps on oozing.
Thanks for the call, Ralph. Derek in Stevens Point, Wisconsin.
Yeah, good about this. You nailed it with, I think you nailed it, Dan, with Trump's selection of people, you know, that he surrounded himself with to help, quote unquote, fix this issue. I think it's akin to a celebrity or a professional athlete going out to the club, getting drunk, and having his Ferrari parked next to a cab. Gee, let's see. I'm a millionaire, and I'm drunk, but instead of taking that cab home, I'll drive myself. What could go wrong?
All right, thanks for the call, Derek.
Listen to podcast of Dan and Amy from the AM 560 mobile app. Download it today at 560theanswer.com/mobile. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. So I went to see Equalizer 2. You know, the new Denzel Washington movie.
Oh, how was it?
Yeah, it was good. It was entertaining. Denzel Washington's always good. He's one of those guys, you go see everything he does because it's always going to be pretty interesting or entertaining, even if it's not like the best script. So Equalizer, right? You know, this is the remake or the movieification of the 80s series. Edward Woodward played the Equalizer. Mm-hmm. Denzel, a little bit more violent than Edward Woodward was back in the day. But it's good. If you like the first one, you'll like the second one. One of the characteristics of the Equalizer, though, big reader. And there's this moment in the movie Equalizer 2 where Denzel is sort of trying to mentor this kid in this apartment complex in which he lives. So he gives him a book, and it's Ta-Nehisi Coates. And I was so disappointed that Denzel would allow Hollywood to have to shoehorn Ta-Nehisi Coates, who's one of these kind of celebrated next generation pseudo intellects, with the same rap, just written better than the poverty pimps of a bygone era. Ta-Nehisi Coates blames the wealth gap in America on slavery and racist New Deal policies. Interesting, as a man of the left, at least there's some recognition of the racism of the left at certainly throughout American history, including into the present, less recognition in the present. But OK, so I was disappointed by that. But here's the good news. The good news is there's this young man named Coleman Hughes, who's a black student at Columbia University. He's an undergrad philosophy major at Columbia, and he's been writing in Quillette, and we've covered one of the previous pieces he's written, and he's taken on all of the charlatans that continue to promote the same big government, small individual policies that have negatively impacted black families and exacerbated the wealth gap. In point of fact, he's taken on Michael Eric Dyson. He's taken on Ta-Nehisi Coates, as he does here. He's taken on Mersha Baradarin as well. His piece, Black American Culture and the Racial Wealth Gap. I mean, this is so well done, and it's shocking that it's an undergrad in this day and age. This is just excellent piece. This is at Quillette.com. He starts talking about the racial wealth gap. Compare that to the household salary disparity, household income disparity. Household income, wealth, two different things. There's arguably no racial disparity more striking than the wealth gap. While the median white household earns just 65% more income than its black counterpart, its net worth is fully 10 times as high. Unlike income, which individuals earn over their lifetimes, wealth accrues over generations. Whites are more than three times as likely as blacks to inherit money from their families. In a public debate on racial inequality, the wealth gap is among the sharpest arrows in the progressives' quiver. And this is sort of waved off as, you know, discussion over. This is obviously the product of slavery and some racist policies over the years. Well, he looks into that. Somebody actually following the logic of an argument or the lack of logic. Looking for evidence or the lack of evidence. He notes the salient question should have never been who's to blame for blacks' predicament, but who's able to fix it. If the problem were simply a lack of cash, then the government would be the ideal candidate. But if we've learned anything from the explosion of violent crime and single motherhood following the welfare expansion in the 60s, it was that cash transfers cannot solve a problem that the absence of cash didn't cause.
What's this undergrad's name again?
Coleman Hughes is his name. Slavery. Slavery is hardly the root cause of America's prosperity. If it were, we would expect American states that practice slavery to be richer than those that did not, yet we see precisely the opposite. The South, where slavery thrived, was the poorest and most backward region of the country, according to Thomas Sowell. That remains true today. A recent analysis of census data found that northeastern states, which forbade slavery, are among the wealthiest, whereas states of the southeast are among the poorest. Nor is the disconnect between slavery and wealth unique to America. Similar disparities have emerged in Brazil, where the former abolitionist southern region has been and continues to be wealthier than the former slave-owning northern region. Ta-Nehisi Coates, his mistaken view about the origin of American prosperity, slavery, and thus the disparity, that's his argument, is part of a larger fallacy about national wealth in general, the assumption that if a nation is wealthy, it must have stolen the wealth from somebody else. To the contrary, a nation's wealth has more to do with the economic system it adopts and the set of skills its citizens possess. The example of Singapore. Although it was raided by Portugal in the 17th century, colonized by Britain in the 19th, Singapore is wealthier than both Portugal and Britain in terms of median wealth per adult. How do you explain that? Ta-Nehisi Coates. Second factor that's offered as an explanation by the left, New Deal policies designed to promote home ownership, income growth, wealth accrual. Whites received the vast majority of government-backed mortgage loans after World War II. By the time the civil rights gains of the 60s, made these loans available to blacks, it was too late. The previous two decades, during which housing values rapidly appreciated, had already passed, and blacks, reeling from the effects of redlining and income suppression, couldn't enter the housing market at its new prices. Wealth became a birthright for whites. Meanwhile, deprived of such wealth transfers, poverty became a permanent trap for blacks. That's the left's argument. But while there's truth to the racist policies, Coleman Hughes makes the point that this argument has been advanced to give the false impression that benevolence of the state is a prerequisite for wealth accrual. And he notes that actually white men's income more than tripled between 39 and 60, but the median income of black men more than quintupled during that same period. Black women, too, saw their income grow at a faster rate than white women over the same time span. So there's something else at play. The prevailing progressive narrative, writes Hughes, also gives short shrift to the history of immigrant groups succeeding in the face of hostility and at the help of government. Japanese Americans, for example, starting with the California Alien Land Law of 1913, 14 states passed laws preventing Japanese-American peasant farmers from owning land and property, preventing them from owning land and property. These laws existed till 1952, not to mention the internment of Japanese-Americans during World War II. So they were given no bootstraps, the Japanese-Americans. Nevertheless, by 1970, census data shows Japanese-Americans out-earning Anglo-Americans, Irish-Americans, German-Americans, Italian-Americans, Polish-Americans. For Asian-Americans on the whole, analysis of wealth data from 1989 to 2013 predicted their median wealth will soon surpass the white median level. So if wealth differences were largely explained by America's history of favoring certain groups over others, it's hard to explain why Asian Americans, who were never favored, are on track to become wealthier than whites, isn't it? Historical racism doesn't explain disparities between groups of the same race. Coleman Hughes references a 2015 survey of wealth in Boston, finding that the median black household in Boston had only $8 of wealth. But the $8 figure only pertained to black Bostonians of American ancestry. Black Bostonians of Caribbean ancestry had $12,000 of wealth. Despite having identical rates of college graduation, only slightly higher incomes, and being equally black in the same city. Same disparities emerge when people are grouped by religion. Jewish households, 7-to-1 wealth advantage over conservative Protestant households, despite the fact that Protestants obviously have been favored over Jews for most of American history. So when you start to look at the arguments advanced by the left and bump it up against the history and the data, it all falls apart. So what explains these disparities? Culture. Cultural differences within group. Conspicuous by absence in the progressive account of the racial wealth gap is any active role for blacks themselves. There are certain elements of black culture, this is Hughes' writing, that if changed would allow blacks to amass wealth to a degree that no government policy would be likely to match. No element of culture harms black wealth accrual more directly than spending patterns. Now we're getting to it. A 2017 Nielsen report found that compared to white women, black women were 14% more likely to own a luxury vehicle, 16% more likely to purchase costume jewelry, and 9% more likely to purchase fine jewelry. A similar Nielsen report from 2013 found that while only 62% of all Americans owned a smartphone, 71% of blacks owned one. The spending differences were unconditional on wealth and income. So to what extent, asked Hughes, do poor spending habits explain the persistence of the wealth gap? Economists at U of C and University of Pennsylvania asked this question, looked at 16 years of nationally representative data from consumer surveys. They found that blacks with comparable incomes to whites spend 17% less on education and 32% more on visible goods, cars, jewelry, clothes. What's more, after controlling for visible spending, they concluded the wealth gap between blacks and whites conditional on a permanent income declines by 50%. The wealth gap declines by 50% when you control for spending patterns. To be clear, that 50% doesn't pertain to the total wealth gap, but to the proportion of the gap. Okay, but it cuts it in half. The upshot, the fact that blacks spent more on cars, jewelry, and clothes explains fully 20% of the total racial wealth gap. Big number. And he goes on to say, you know, people say, oh, this is racist to look at the data and spending habits and other cultural differences between groups. But if you want to eliminate these gaps, you have to understand why they exist, don't you? He says, is it racist to observe that whites are more likely to drive drunk than blacks are? That's true. Is it racist to assert that black immigrants in the UK outscore comparable white Britons on standardized tests? Is it racist to observe that black American cultures produce a higher number of musical icons than Asian American culture? If it's not racist to mention these facts, why is it racist to mention the same kinds of facts when they run in the opposite direction? Particularly when you have cultural differences within racial groups, as the Boston example provides. Same race, right? 4-to-1 income ratio difference between Taiwanese Americans and Hmong Americans in the Asian category. Discussing the different patterns of behavior that underlie such intra-racial disparities can't be racist by definition. Race and culture, though often correlated, are entirely different concepts. So the whole discussion of wealth disparities, income disparities, achievement disparities is so much more about culture than it is race. And when you look at something that the progressives hang their hat on, the wealth gap between the races, it's almost entirely explained, particularly in 2018 America, by culture. So do you want to advance ideas that would eliminate those gaps, that would encourage others who are not practicing behaviors that put them in the best position for independence and wealth creation they can pass down to their ancestors? Or do you just want to play the white-black binary game? Thankfully, we have young intellects in this country like Coleman Hughes who are trying to close those gaps.
There's only one radio show in Chicago talking about today's biggest stories and telling you what they really mean. That show is this one. Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. If you're looking for the latest news, insight into what it means, and the sharpest opinion, there's only one station in Chicago where you can turn, and it's this one. We're AM 560, The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. So Trump is compensating those injured by friendly fire in his trade war to the tune of $12 billion. $12 billion in aid to farmers negatively impacted by the you tax your people, I tax my people trade war Trump has initiated. There's a very good piece from a former Caterpillar executive in the Wall Street Journal over the weekend referencing the zero tariffs precedent, the effort led by Caterpillar in the 80s, along with other big manufacturers and agribusinesses, international paper, other companies, to push for a zero tariff paradigm in global trade. That was one way to leverage American power, push, we're going to go zero tariff. We have all these companies signed on to be zero tariffs, even though tariffs in some instances in some markets would protect their market share. Zero tariff is better in the long run. That's what we want. Trump could be doing that. He's not. So he's hurting and helping, picking and choosing. It's the sort of mercantilism I despise, and all free market, growth-oriented conservatives should.
It's farm aid early. I mean, it's coming in September, right before the midterm elections, and really how farmers apply and receive the money, those details are still being worked out.
Yeah.
The fact is they don't want it.
I'm fine for farm aid if Willie Nelson is on stage. Exactly. I'm not fine if it's government-sponsored. Let's talk to one of those conservative free market types. He's Steve Moore. He's Wall Street Journal columnist and chief economist for CNN. Steve, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Hi. Good morning, guys.
$12 billion in farm subsidies to provide some redress to those who've been injured.
Well, look, I guess you guys are burying the lead a little bit here. I mean, the big story is that last night, about 9 or 10 o'clock at night, you know, Trump I think he must have been reading my piece from last week, because he did call for the, he said, let's go to the zero tariff option. And this is something, as you know, you guys know, I've been pushing this for weeks. Larry Kudlow has been pushing it. This idea of let's de-escalate, let's bring the tariffs down to zero, have the other nations bring their tariffs and subsidies down to zero. If you do that, by the way, the United States benefits relatively, because our tariffs are lower than virtually any other country's tariffs. That's a point we've been making to Trump.
So this is the meeting with the EU this morning?
Pardon me?
This is the meeting with the EU this morning?
Well, that starts in a couple of hours, and I think he's going to put that on the table. He's going to challenge the Europeans to say, let's go to zero. Now, there's some dissension within the White House on this. I've been over there several times talking to them about this, but
Trump kind of gets it, that this is, by the way, this totally, if he puts this on the table with, what's the guy's name? I love that his good name, Juncker.
Oh, yes, yeah, Sebastian Juncker, yeah.
The European Trade Commissioner's name is Juncker. He's going to talk about auto tariffs, right? His name is Juncker. But anyway, look, David Trump, Pepper, I think, is very serious about this because, you know, that we've been saying to him all along, the problem is we want to get these countries to lower their tariffs, not to raise them. We don't want a tit-for-tat, you know, increase in the tariffs. And I, you know, when I was over at the White House a few days ago, I made the analogy, by the way, you guys are way too young to remember this, but in the 1980s, when Ronald Reagan was president, you know, when he was first president, oh, he's a warmonger, you know, he's going to cause a nuclear, you know, a nuclear war and all of this stuff. And then in 1987, very famous summit in Reykjavik in Iceland, Ronald Reagan surprises Gorbachev by saying, why don't we move towards total nuclear disarmament? And it put the Russians on their heels. They didn't expect this. And although they didn't come away with the deal there in Reykjavik, it was the first step to the biggest nuclear disarmament in world history. And we use that analogy to say, look, you can do this on tariffs. You can get all of these countries, you know, if they will agree to it, to reduce their tariffs. So instead of having a future with really high tit for tat, higher tariffs, we get every country to get their tariffs down. Now, here's the last thing about this that is interesting. Trump did put that on the table at the last hours of the G7 meeting about a month ago in Canada, and this was not widely reported by the press. But none of the Europeans had any interest in that. I mean, they're free trade frauds. They want to pretend like the villain here is Donald Trump, when in fact they have much higher tariffs, much higher non-tariff trade barriers than we do. And we'll see what reaction Trump gets from the Europeans to putting this deal on the table. But I think it gives them the moral high ground in the debate.
Yeah, well, what if they don't bite? I mean, then these tariffs stay
in
place.
Well,
farmers want markets and opportunities. They do not want handouts.
But look, let me ask you this question. I mean, if we put zero tariffs on the table and the Europeans say no, then, you know, we want to, what, we're just going to have unilateral open up our markets and like other countries don't open up their markets to us? I mean, the whole reason, Amy, that Trump was elected is American people are sick of that. They feel like the rest of the world takes advantage of us, whether it's not paying their NATO dues, whether it's, you know, United States signing off to this lunatic, you know, treaty on climate change where we pay all the bills, and whether it's the other countries taking advantage of us on the trade deals where we lower our tariffs and they don't lower their tariffs on us. What alternative do we have? Do we just live with the status quo where countries like China and steal our technologies and don't abide by the trade deals that they've agreed to?
Well, I mean, you're conflating a lot of issues there. I mean, there's a difference between paying your fair share in the NATO alliance and you tax your people and weaken your industry through protectionism, so we're going to do the same thing. Those aren't the same things. And oh, by the way, but just hold on a second. Oh, but you just had this report. The U.S. reached an all-time record high, $2 trillion in the first quarter manufacturing input this year. So maybe the manufacturing sector doesn't need protection from the government gang who can't shoot straight.
Well, look, I find myself in some agreement with that. I do believe if there is a level playing field, the United States manufacturers, our farmers, can compete anywhere in the world. We have the best farmers. We have the best companies. We have the best entrepreneurs in the world. We have the most productive workers in the world. So, yeah, but it's a little difficult to compete on the international stage when all these other countries are putting barriers to our exports. You know, it is absolutely true that our tariffs are about one half the level of the tariffs that other countries. Why shouldn't Donald Trump demand that those countries reduce their tariffs? Now look,
I'm all for that.
Every one of these countries, Dan, needs access to the U.S. market. And what's not being really reported in the media is China is in big trouble right now. I mean, China cannot win this trade war with the United States. Their entire economy depends on having access to the U.S. market. And all we're saying is behave yourselves, play by the rules, stop stealing, and we can have a free trade, a Milton Friedman type of free trade agreement.
Well, what's your gut feeling for today?
Pardon?
What do you think is going to happen today? What's your gut feeling?
if they don't stop stealing?
Yeah. No, do you think that they'll agree to zero tariffs? Limiting tariffs altogether.
Look, China steals our intellectual property. We know that by hundreds of billions of dollars a year. And every president, including Bush, including Clinton, Obama, did nothing about it. Now we have a president who's standing toe-to-toe with them, Beijing, and saying he can't do it any longer. Look, if they're not going to behave, we can't have a trading relationship with them. I mean, I think that's the point that Trump is making, is we're going to use our leverage, and we're going to punish you if you keep stealing and if you keep putting our exports into disadvantage. Now, Dan, if Milton Friedman were on the show right now, he would say, well, we should just have unilateral free trade.
Yes,
just open
that's
up our markets
say.
To any country that wants to.
That is what he would say.
You know, I used to be for that, but I'm not for that anymore. I'm for we lower our trade barriers. They have to do the same. That's the whole point of these trade deals. But none of these countries actually abide by them.
So then are you also, if they raise their trade barriers, they go the other way? Well, not only are we going to not lower them, we're going to hit you. So we want to escalate this war. So then we should escalate too. If both have to go low, then if our adversaries / competitors / allies go high, we go high.
You can't have a free trade agreement with a country if they don't abide by it. I mean, that's the point I'm making, is we have these free trade deals with these countries, most of them, and yet virtually none of them have actually, done what they said they would do. And, you know, that does put American farmers at a disadvantage. It does put our manufacturers at a disadvantage. And incidentally, I'm optimistic. I think Trump is going to win here. You know, Germany is coming. I mean, the Europeans are coming hand in hand today. We'll see how this turns out. But Germany is quaking. I mean, if you put this idea of an auto import tariff, which, by the way, I'm not in favor of, but that kills Germany. And Germany's economy is dependent on selling cars to the United States. China needs to sell stuff to the United States. I think Trump is saying this is a game that these other countries can't win. Whether they recognize that or not, we'll see.
So the play is that we're willing to inflict, we can inflict more damage on them. They can inflict some damage on us, and we can inflict some damage on us. So we're going, the combination of America and all of these trading partners subject to the tariffs, we're going to decimate their economies. We're going to hurt our economy. And at some point in the distant future, everybody's going to recognize that we've done the eye for an eye. Everybody goes blind game. And we're going to be zero tariffs and recover from all of this.
Well, Dan, look, here's the point. First of all, you should be in a good mood this morning. I mean, Trump has put zero. You're a free trader, right? Amy, you're a free trader. I believe in free trade. Trump wants free trade. He says, I want to get rid of zero tariffs, zero subsidies, zero non-tariffs. And basically he was saying, I think he's sincere about this, any country wants to step up and have this deal with the United States, step right up. You got a deal. And I think what you're going to start to see, and this is why I think Trump is not for these multilateral trade agreements. We should have bilateral trade agreements. We should start with the UK, with Britain, and say, look, zero tariffs between the two of us. Let's do it. Sign right up. And then you sort of isolate the countries with high tariffs, and it forces them to bring their tariffs down. Whether this works or not, we will see. Dan, you make a good point. Maybe this doesn't work. Maybe it leads to an escalation, which is not what I want, not what you want, and I don't think what Trump wants. He doesn't want these countries to impose higher tariffs. He wants them to impose lower tariffs.
I want to get your take on another policy advanced by a Republican, since this is your wheelhouse. Carlos Curbelo, who's a Republican congressman from Florida, introduced a greenhouse tax proposal, $24 per metric ton of greenhouse gas emissions, growing 2% per year above inflation, an additional $2 per ton every 2 years, blah, blah, blah. The whole idea is to meet our emission reduction goals and diversify and clean up our energy sources in this country.
So, first of all, you know, I was just looking at this data that literally just came out a few weeks ago on how many countries are meeting their Paris Climate Accord, targets for 2018. You know, how many reached their targets in 2017 of the 30 major countries in the world?
Zero.
Zero. And most of them didn't come anywhere close to meeting their targets. And incidentally, in the last 3 or 4 years, the country that is, I've said this before, I'll say it again on your show, the country that has lowered its greenhouse gas emissions the most, and its carbon emissions the most, is the United States. And we're not even in that stupid Paris Accord. It's exactly why these treaties make no sense. We abide by the treaty. We're not part of it. They are part of the treaty, and they badmouth us, and yet they're none of them. And most of these countries are like 50% of their target. They're anywhere near reaching their agreement. So, look, the country that needs to impose carbon taxes is these other nations, not us. And we have natural gas. Natural gas is a wonder fuel. It reduces, you know, it produces a lot of energy. We're exporting this stuff around the world. We're using more of it for electricity. And it's a clean burning fuel. And by the way, it says a lot about the environmentalists that they hate natural gas too, even though natural gas is what reduces greenhouse gas emissions. So we don't need a carbon tax. We don't need a you know, greenhouse gas emission tax. We just need to use more of our own homegrown energy.
All right. He is Steve Moore, Wall Street Journal columnist and chief economist for CNN. Steve, thanks as always for joining us.
If we get to zero tariffs, you're buying me a lunch at Trulux. You know, right there downtown.
Yeah, I know
because
where it
I think
is.
Trump is going to win here because Trump always wins.
All right, I'll
and
buy
I'll
you.
Go, but it'll be at a different location.
And Amy, you're coming as my date.
Oh, I'll yes. buy you an eco-friendly lunch.
It went well last time.
Yeah.
All right, place. Have
thanks,
a great day,
Steve.
Guys.
Thanks, Stephen Moore, and he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
Connect with Dan and Amy on the AM 560 The Answer mobile app. Just text the word app to 64636 to download the app today. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. Trump just trolling? Not serious about revoking the security clearances of the Obama 6? Brennan, Rice,
Comey,
McCabe, Hayden, and clap on, clap off, clap on, clap off, James Clapper.
Brennan. Angry pants.
Paul Ryan said as much. Don't really take it too seriously.
I think he's trolling people, honestly. this is something that's in the purview of the executive branch. I think some of these people have already lost their clearances. I think he's just trolling people.
Hmm.
Well, McComey and McCabe, since they were fired, I heard that they did lose their security clearance.
Well,
it's part of their separation package so they could spend more time with their family.
Well, Paul Ryan may not think Trump is serious about it. Maybe Trump isn't serious about it, but Rand Paul is. He seriously thinks the security clearances should be revoked for these guys. And frankly, across the board, once you leave government, you should no longer have security clearance, Rand Paul making the argument.
Well, you know, I told the president in private what I've been saying in public, that I think there's a great danger to having talking heads on TV who are ex-CIA agents and still have classified clearance. There's a real danger that they might inadvertently reveal classified information. And, you know, John Brennan's got a history of this. Back in 2012, when we were discussing, you know, we discovered the underwear bomber, John Brennan at that time briefed ex-CIA agents who were retired but still had top secret clearance. He briefed them and said, oh, don't worry, the U.S. has someone inside. We have inside control. Well, then one of these ex-CIA agents went on television and said, oh, yeah, we have a double agent and nobody needs to worry. And it's like, whoops, the double agent was still there. So John Brennan's already been involved when he was on the inside leaking information to people who still had top secret clearance who were now talking heads. John Brennan leaked information that almost cost the life of a double agent. This is 4 years ago now.
That's a good example, and this is why Rand Paul concludes.
But I would make it more universal. I don't think that ex-CIA agents of any stripe who are now talking heads should continue to get classified information. I think it's wrong.
For more on this and other topics, we're pleased to be joined by Rich Lowry. He's the editor of National Review, nationalreview.com, Fox News contributor, author of the book Lincoln Unbound. Rich, thanks for being with us again. Appreciate it.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So revoking the security clearances of those individuals named part of draining the swamp, or is it, as Clapper said, is it a petty political retribution?
I think it's a petty
thing, the way they're rolling this out and presenting it. I think Rand Paul makes a case for what would be a categorical rule or change in how you do this globally, but just targeting these couple people feels petty. Not that I have any use for John Brennan or for Clapper, and I think they've really kind of disgraced themselves, and it's really bad practice for people who had some of the most sensitive powers in the United States government to immediately come out and out themselves as poisonous partisans. I think that's really bad. It undermines faith in our system, but I don't think this is the way to go about
but,
it.
Elections have consequences, and their team lost, so I was surprised to know that they still have access to sensitive information. And why do they? Can you explain that?
Well, I mean, the theory is that, say, in a crisis, you might want former officials to have access to this information again, or you might just routinely want to consult them over sensitive matters, so you want them to have the clearance. So I don't think, obviously, the Trump administration in
that's not likely.
Is ever going to coordinate with John Brennan over anything. Another rationale I've heard is that if you want to talk to Brennan about past things you're wondering how he handled, you'd still want him to have a security clearance. But I'm not opposed to some broad change in the policy. I just think specifically targeting, you know, five or six people who've irritated and criticized you is not a good look.
A lot of attention paid to Trump's Twitter war with Iranian dictator Rouhani, and not enough, and you made this point at National Review as well, not enough paid to the speech that his Secretary of State, Mike Pompeo, gave Sunday at the Reagan Library on Iran, and where he laid out in great detail, I mean, it was really Reagan-esque in its quality, so the venue was appropriate, great detail, the corruption of the Iranian mullahs, a good historical perspective on the revolution four decades later. I mean, it was really a powerful, thoughtful speech that probably should have got more attention than the Twitter war between the two principals.
Yeah, it was a tremendous speech, and really it was a regime change kind of speech. That's
yeah.
Technically not their policy. But, you know, again, on Trump's tweet, it's like a lot of these things, I understand the impulse. The Iranians are threatening us, and you really want to push back. And, you know, Trump did on Twitter in all caps, but that's not really the main event. The main event is coming here on August 6th when a lot of the sanctions snap back. And then by November, we hope to get to zero to really cancel out all Iranian oil exports. It would be a very big deal. I don't think we're not going to get all the way to zero, but we can put a really crimp in it. And that's 80% of Iran's exports. And Iran is already in a slow-moving economic crisis prior to us reapplying any of the sanctions. So we have a lot of leverage here. I don't think we're going to, you know, a lot of people were worried when Trump was doing the Fire and Fury campaign against Kim Jong-un that it heralded, you know, potential war. I think we can be a little wiser now that the tweet doesn't mean we're on the cusp of military conflict with Iran, but we are in a confrontation with them. And when Trump first pulled out of the deal, everyone's like, oh, this is the end of the Western alliance. We'll never have any leverage over them, and the Iranians will immediately break out towards a nuclear weapon. None of that's happened, and we clearly have a lot of cards to play.
Speaking of Kim Jong-un, a report out this week that satellite images show Kim keeping his pledge ostensibly to dismantle key missile launch sites. How much should we be encouraged by the report of Kim Jong-un moving in a direction towards denuclearization, apparently?
I think it's good. Obviously, it's better than the alternative. It still, for me, would be in accord with a longer-term approach that would be good for Kim and bad for us, which is just to string us along, to make it harder for us to maintain the sanctions regime, to entice the South Koreans and the Chinese to letting up the pressure or lobbying us to give them exceptions to start doing business with North Korea. And I don't think, you know, Kim was going to be able just totally to stiff Trump and get away with it. So I think an approach that makes more sense from his perspective is actually to do some stuff and to string us along. So Unfortunately, this whole thing so far has played out with my most pessimistic scenario. It's consistent with my most pessimistic scenario. Now, maybe there's some small chance that there's really a real change of heart in this regime and he's really going to denuclearize, but I think that's very unlikely.
President Trump and Kim Jong-un, they, you know, started out on Twitter and then they eventually met face-to-face. Do you think President Trump will ever meet face-to-face with Rouhani?
I hope not. I was not a fan of the face-to-face with Kim, so I hope we wouldn't do it with the Iranians as well. And if he did that, I hope it would only happen when the regime is really on its knees.
Spanning the globe of dictators and ne'er-do-wells, to not much fanfare, Daniel Ortega has reemerged in Nicaragua. He gave a rather remarkable and curious, by choosing to do so, interview with Brett Baer on Fox News this week. And Brett did a nice job trying to hold Ortega to account for, you know, the old Marxist repression of making people disappear, murdering protesters and the like. And I just look at Venezuela and Nicaragua, the protests in Managua, the government's reaction, the oppression and repression, and Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and Comrade Bernie running around the Midwest arguing for quote-unquote democratic socialism with other than the violence mirrors a lot of the policies you see in Central and South America. And I just wonder if Ocasio-Cortez and Comrade Bernie turn out to be the Republicans' greatest weapon this fall.
Yeah, so first of all, I mean, it's just very depressing and amazing how enduring the Daniel Ortega and his family have been. I mean, we thought we'd gotten rid of them in the 1980s or the early 1990s,
yeah.
But they're still there, so sort of Castro-like and still destroying their country. So the worst-case scenario there is that really you have a Venezuela-type meltdown. And, you know, I will say this for Bernie and his ilk. We are a liberal society. I don't think we're ever going down the Venezuela path, but this is, you know, there's an organic connection. These are socialists, so you think they would feel a little more ownership of these kind of regimes than they do. And lastly, yeah, the Democrats' lurch left is the best thing Republicans have going. There was a Wall Street Journal poll that showed a couple days ago that more people than ever think that the Democratic congressional candidates are out of the mainstream. The favorable rating of the Democratic Party is 35%. The favorable rating for the Republican Party is 34%. So Democrats, you know, they may win the House. They may even win it big, depending on how things slide here the last 100 days. But they are a party that is in the midst of its own identity crisis and slow-rolling revolution.
He is Rich Lowry, editor of National Review, nationalreview.com, Fox News contributor, author of the book Lincoln Unbound. Rich, thanks as always for joining us. Appreciate it.
Hey, thanks for having me.
And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
You're listening to Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560. The Answer.
I love Clemson football coach Dabo Sweeney. Not just because his name's Dabo.
Who names their kid? Oh, look how cute he is. Let's name him Dabo.
I like Dabo. If I have another fictional son, I'm going to name him Dabo. You remember Dabo Sweeney opined last year during the season about, or maybe it was 2 years ago now, about in the height of sort of the Black Lives Matter, the consternation and unrest in Ferguson. And he talked about in this country not having a black and white problem. We got a sin problem. And talked about, you know, there are bad cops, just like there are bad football coaches. There are bad people in every profession. There are a lot of good people, too. Sweeney sat down for an interview in advance of this coming college football season with ESPN. And he was asked about how he stays so positive. Listen to Dabo's response.
Man, that's the easiest question I've had all day. Well, I mean, to me, that's just the priorities of my life. That's just my... You know, I think that I made a decision when I was 16. I grew up in a family that, you know, I was taught, you know, there was a God and all that, but I didn't really have a relationship with Christ until I was 16. And that was a game changer for me. That's really become the foundation of my life. And me personally, I don't really – it's hard to survive and thrive in this world if you don't have a spiritual foundation and have something that you know, you can, that will give you peace, because life is hard, and we're all going to experience death and failure and setbacks and disappointments and cancer, and you know, you just, it's just, it's a really difficult world. And for me, God is always, in my relationship with Christ, he's given me hope and peace. And you know, I love Jeremiah 29:11, you know, "For I know the plans I have for you." That's kind of been a life verse for me. It says to give you, you know, a hope and a future. They're plans for good, not disaster. And so I've always taken that, and I've kind of applied that to my life along my journey. You know, everybody sees me now, and I'm the head coach of Clemson and all this and that, but, you know, my life hasn't always been this way. And I've always used that as, to me, if there's really hope in the future, then there's power in the present.
I really like that, too. I like this reminder that, you know, you see somebody on top as a national championship coach and, you know, a very successful career at Clemson over the last decade, and you think, well, that guy's always been there. Or, you know, that guy had this glide path to the top. No. And not the case.
Nothing comes easy.
No, not the case.
Things come well with hard work.
And the other thing that's nice about Dabo Swinney is you see somebody who's not just a coach, very much in the Wood model, but he's also sort of a shaper of young men. And that, to me, perhaps is the secret of his success at Clemson, turning around that program, making it a perennial power. I mean, that's certainly part of it. He's a leader. And leadership matters in any organization, not just sports. The leaders of sports organizations are just more public. So it's just interesting.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. When you've got questions, he always has an answer. It's Sean Hannity, this afternoon at 2, right before Joe Walsh at 5 on AM 560, The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. And we heard in Mike Scott's newscast the Toronto shooter that killed two women, injured more than a dozen others. Pakistani Canadian, characterized by his family as suffering from depression. We know from friends in Toronto and now news reports that he was known to police, that he had some experience, if not training, with firearms. And now ISIS has claimed that he was one of their terrorist warriors.
Oh, that's strange, because his parents came out with a joint statement with Toronto police saying that he suffered depression and mental illness and psychosis.
Nothing to do with being an Islamist.
Nothing at all.
Not radicalized.
Never mentioned.
Yeah, it's always disconcerting when you have law enforcement appearing to conspire to mislead you. And the key thing that you said was law enforcement and the CBC not releasing the name of the shooter until they did so in conjunction with a statement that had already been prepared and released simultaneously by his family. Strange. For more on this topic and others of national security import, we're pleased to be joined by Bill Gertz, senior editor for the Washington Free Beacon, author of the book I War, War and Peace in the Information Age. Bill, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Hi, Dan and Amy. Good to be on the show.
If the reports are, well, if ISIS isn't just claiming credit without foundation, what does that say about kind of the current state of play with respect to radical Islamist terrorism? We've been diverted in terms of our attention to Russia and to North Korea, to some extent Central and South America, immigration policy. And we haven't talked much in the last several months about the threat that radical Islamic terror still poses.
Yeah, the good news is in Syria, the U.S. and the allies there have done a really good job of decimating the Islamic State terror group. I mean, they are definitely no longer controlling the same kind of territory that they did a couple of years ago. The bad news is that a lot of the people that went there to fight jihad and to conduct attacks and to try and take part in this Islamic caliphate that no longer exists there, people have gone to their home states and are basically following the directive to conduct attacks in their home countries. Whether this Canadian attack was a terror attack, we'll probably need to get a few more details, but We just don't know at this point.
There seems to be growing concern. I was reading a number of articles about residents in Toronto fearing that this would happen. Do you know what their immigration policy is like in Canada?
Well, you know, they definitely have a liberal immigration policy, and they have not been that good on dealing with the terrorist threat. I know that they work closely with the U.S. in that area. The U.S. is very careful to see that terrorists don't use Canada as a stepping point for entering the United States. But, you know, it seems to me that the real threats we have these days are from people that are mentally ill or from terrorists. Those seem to be the main motivations behind the kind of mass shootings that we've been seeing so often.
I wanted to just get your take on the FISA courts. You know, the left wants to abolish ICE. Bill McGurn in the Wall Street Journal writing that we should abolish FISA courts, this in the aftermath of the release of the Carter Page FISA application documents. He suggests that we've gotten to this place. I mean, again, FISA courts have been around for 40-some years, not that long, not the founding of the nation, not constitutional per se. He invokes, as McGurn, Robert Bork, who warned about the FISA courts at the advent of their creation, a concern that the courts would just defer to intelligence agencies and become a rubber stamp, which arguably FISA has become. Why not make executives who spy on American citizens or engage in the sort of behavior that is authorized by the FISA court directly accountable for the decisions they make, as opposed to hiding behind judges? What do you say to that with respect to the FISA court?
Yeah, it's a tough call. Domestic spying is very difficult, and it's a useful tool for both law enforcement and counterterrorism intelligence gathering and for counter-spying as well. But it does create these problems. There's no question in my mind that what we saw in the Carter Page declassified FISA application, which again was heavily redacted, was that they used bad information. They had a politicized dossier and from several different directions coming in, and they used that to spy on the Trump campaign. I mean, that's really the bottom line. It was an abuse of power by the FBI. Now, I think that they can, if they can recognize that and admit that, then they got to make some reforms and try to fix that problem. But to say that there's no indication that this was politicization, and of course, you have Peter Strzok, the center of this whole FBI scandal, claiming that he was not biased when clearly his text showed that, you know, he was out to stop the Trump campaign and prevent Trump from becoming president. So it's clearly a huge problem for the FBI, and I think the Trump administration really needs to institute some major reforms of the FBI, and that's really where the problem comes.
Well, now,
I think the FISA court is needed, definitely.
You do think the FISA court is needed, because what I was going to say, I mean, the documents release, it is worth noting, just to push back against McGurn's argument, that you had Jim Comey sign off, you had Sally Yates sign off at Department of Justice, so it's not like they're absolved of responsibility just because it's a judge that's making the ultimate decision. Maybe you'll get judges that now, in the wake of some of these revelations, no longer just serve as rubber stamps.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, they need to tighten up the procedures, and the procedures are already tight. In other words, especially when they approve a surveillance of an American, they're required to have extraordinary evidence that this is really needed. When it involves a foreign subject, like a foreign terrorist or a foreign spy, then it's less stringent, the requirements for the FISA application. But in this case, when they're asking for permission to spy on an American, and an American who's a member of a political campaign, a presidential campaign, I think that there really were some lapses in the whole process.
Now, and then learning, too, that when James Comey went to the Trump Tower to meet with then-candidate Trump, he didn't even tell him where the Steele dossier came from, that it was actually funded by the Democrats. Do you think he stepped in it there as well?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, this whole thing just stinks of politicization of the FBI at the upper levels. You know, and again, I think that it's time for some major reforms. They've got to recognize that they have a problem within the FBI and work to depoliticize it.
Well, where are we on North Korea in your estimation? We were just talking to Rich Lowry at the top of the hour about this and about the report this week that Kim Jong-un is dismantling some key missile launch sites. Is this just sort of a show to keep America strung along on the topic, or is this a positive indication of a substantive step towards denuclearization?
Very hard to say. Any kind of overhead surveillance, spy satellites and things for North Korea has to be very, very carefully evaluated, because the North Koreans are very good at hiding things underground. So whenever they claim that they're dismantling some missile testing facilities and things like that, that could be done because they know clearly that they can fool U.S. intelligence into thinking that they're taking some positive steps. The U.S. is absolutely wants to see that kind of thing, so they're really showing U.S. intelligence what they want to believe, that North Korea is going to go along with this very difficult process of denuclearization.
And then the last axis of evil country we want to discuss, of course, Iran, Rouhani. And the speech that Pompeo gave this week, where he included, in addition to sort of a lot of history of Iran since the revolution, an overture to those pro-small-d democracy forces in Iran, sort of encouragement for regime change coming from the inside. And I wonder, in the context of what you just described, the landscape is in Syria, where you think we are with Iran and how we should be triangulating them in the Middle East.
Yeah, I think this is the kind of thing we're seeing that the Trump administration do, both through the president's tweet as well as Pompeo's statements and support for the Iranian people. This is the kind of information warfare that we need to be doing to really help the people of Iran to change their system, to reform that system, and because they don't want it. They don't want to be ruled by a theocratic state that is supporting terrorists around the world. And of course, you know, Iran is the largest state sponsor of terrorism. They're expanding in the Middle East. They're trying to become the regional hegemon there. And I think using information means, we saw also for the first time the Secretary of State do a tweet in Farsi, which is really the best way to try and reach directly to the Iranian people. So, yeah, I think they're doing the right thing on that.
And for those of us who missed that tweet, what was it? Can you translate?
Oh, I don't know. But it was basically saying that the U.S. supports the Iranian people and not the Iranian government.
He is Bill Gertz, senior editor for the Washington Free Beacon, author of the book I War, War and Peace in the Information Age. Bill, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Hey, thank you.
And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
This is the morning show. More Chicago radio listeners are choosing. This is Chicago's morning answer on AM 560. The answer.
Dan and Amy, and there's science behind dogs coming to your rescue, Amy. Scientists from Johns Hopkins University, no less, took 34 dogs, positioned them behind a door which was closed with magnets, and their owners were on the other side of the door. While sitting behind the door, the owners were asked to either hum Twinkle, Twinkle, Little Star, or pretend to cry. I wonder how much the owners were paid for this. They found that many of the dogs nosed their way through the door, but did it three times more quickly when they thought their owners were upset and needed comforting.
Oh.
Dogs, right? You know, Lassie, get help. Lassie will go get help. Dog owners can tell that their dogs sense their feelings. Our findings reinforce that idea. Dogs have been at the site a few minutes for tens of thousands of years. They've learned to read our social cues. In point of fact, when a dog was not able to get to a crying owner, researchers found those dogs showed the most stressed because couldn't get to their owner to comfort them.
They know. I mean, dog spelled backward is God. They're
small
godly
G.
creatures.
Yeah, that's right. The genesis of this experiment is interesting. A psychology professor at Ripon College, playing with her children, she buried the youngsters, her children buried her in pillows. She began to call for help and play. My husband didn't come to rescue me, but within a few seconds, my collie had dug me out of the pillows. Mm-hmm. I knew we had to do a study to test more of that formally. And that was the impetus for the study.
You know, I know you don't have tear ducts, but does Hayek ever help you? Like when you're
he knows after I come home from a bad round of golf and I'm upset, he sees that I'm downtrodden, on the verge of tears.
And what does Hayek do?
He says,
smack you and say, play a better round tomorrow. What's wrong with you?
Yeah. He says, why don't you take that pee head off and stop with the self-pity and man up?
Yeah.
And it's comforting. What does Bunky do for you?
Bunky knows everything. If we're sad, if something's going on, there's a death in the family or something, she just sits by your side and doesn't move and is depressed all day. It's the weirdest thing. They know when things are off.
So Bunky just does
that. She just knows.
She just does that same thing regardless of what's happening. She just sits there and does nothing all day.
She's active. And when the boys come home, she freaks out. She's so excited. She just jumps up on the furniture, just runs around the room. She loves it when they come home. And she loves when I come home, too, because I'm her mom.
I didn't think she'd take to me. You do that mom stuff. You're her owner.
Hi, baby, the baby. You always have to talk in the baby voice.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.